Good evening, friends. This is Pascal Robert. I'm your current host tonight for This Is Revolution Podcast, the Mile Mile Hour. We will be this evening hosting Daniel Besner, and we'll be talking about the uselessness of hyperpolitics. Please like and subscribe to your page. If you are not become a patron, subscribe for $3 to $30 a month to get our merch and also be able to access our Patreon hour. For our production, we're going to have the great and wonderful M. Toussaint, who is here with us on the screen. M. Toussaint, how are you?
I'm okay. How are you? I'm so sorry. I mixed up the intros.
Oh, yeah, I know. You didn't have my infamous Mama music. It's okay. You didn't throw me off too much.
Okay, I'm sorry about that.
It's all right. We can use it for the extra. But moving on to the show, in his 2020 piece, The End of Mass Politics, Daniel Besner discussed the over-century-long plan by political elites to limit the influence of average citizens on modern politics. As Besner says, beginning with the intellectual revolution of the democratic realists like Walter Lippmann, who insisted that social scientists and decision makers should be the ones making actual political choices, and continuing with mid-century 1930s, 1960s creation of the national security and administrative states, which concentrate power in the hands of small groups of people, U.S. elites have effectively removed the demos from politics. Hundreds of thousands of people all over the world have flooded the streets in protest over Israel and the onslaughts in Gaza. Americans en masse are acknowledging Palestinian humanity. While this bombardment of the people of Gaza, after all the mass protests in the 2010s, is there any uselessness of a hyper-political populace that seems more focused in the spectacle than concrete political victories? Daniel Besner is currently the Annette H. and Kenneth B. Pyle Associate Professor in American Foreign Policy at the University of Washington. He's a member of the Henry M. Jackson School of International Studies and previously held the Geoff Hunter Honors Professorship in Western Civilization. He is also a non-resident fellow at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, an associate of the Alameda Institute, and a continuing contributor to Jacobin. In 2019 to 2020, he served as foreign policy and advisor to Bernie Sanders' presidential campaign. Please welcome friend of the show, Daniel Besner.
Hey, everyone. And Pascal, I saw you left out my sanctioning by Russia.
I don't know if you wanted me to go there. I left it out intentionally to be politically polite.
To who? To whom? I don't know. But yeah.
Well, do you want to talk about that? What happened? What?
Yeah, I'm fine talking. I mean, nothing happened. I don't know really why I was sanctioned. My guess it was some, you know, bureaucratic thing or Kafka-esque choice. I really don't know.
You've been critical of the Russiagate stuff on several occasions.
Yeah. I've been critical of the Russiagate stuff, and I've been critical of the U.S. arming Ukraine. So my guess is that it was random.
Really?
Yeah. I don't think anyone's like looked deeply into my stuff. My guess is it was random.
Right. Well, Daniel, let me tell you something. I've always been profoundly interested with your end of mass politics critique in terms of how it relates to hyperpolitics and whether or not hyperpolitics is something that's a good thing or a bad thing. This is where I want to start with your position. The left, as you know, in America particularly, has always prided itself on its ability to use protest to influence policymakers to get results. This is something that goes back to the labor movement of the early 20th century, goes back to the radical left socialist communists of the early 20th century in terms of the New Deal, going through to the civil rights movement, going back to the anti-war movement of Vietnam. With your position in terms of, since you go back to Walter Lippmann in terms of the attempts by the political elites or what you call the power elite or what it's known by as overall as the power elites to remove the modern population from politics, would you argue that the extent to which the left was responsible for those political policy advances is somewhat blown out of proportion, and there is somewhat of a realpolitik in terms of the machinations of elites behind the scenes that are more at play? Or are you saying that the age of end of mass politics is a more recent phenomenon? I'd like to hear your thoughts on that particular.
No, it's a really good question. I think that the major epochal shifts for me are pre and post World War II, and that has to do with American political development and the maturation of the American state at particular levels and at particular times. I think there was much more ability for masses of people to shape policy and policy making and decision making before World War II. And there was much less ability to shape after, broadly speaking. Foreign policy and the macroeconomy in particular, I think, became issue areas that were walled off from most popular influence and from public opinion. And we could talk about that term too after World War II, because the state formation that was created as a result of the war and as the coming together of a concatenation of ideological and material factors relatively effectively insulated primary choices about what the United States should do in the world and how the United States should organize its political economy, making it more difficult for masses of people to shape things. And where that intersects with the story of the left, I think the left was consciously and effectively eradicated as an institutional force in American life, really after World War II as well. This is true of the radicals within labor unions. This is true of the Communist Party of the USA. This is true later in the 60s of the Black radical tradition and other indigenous and third worldist movements. I think they have been systematically disempowered by the center and the center right. So that's a connected story, but not totally. It doesn't totally overlap. So that's how I would put it, just as a starting point.
Would you argue that this demobilization of the radical left in the United States is something that happens when you say after World War II? Would you say that there's a lot of space between after World War II? You say that starts with the rise of Nixon, or is it?
Oh, no. I mean, they demolished the Communist Party and radical labor in the beginning in the late 40s, earlier, really, but really beginning in the late 40s into the 1950s. And I always think it was very difficult that you were going to have any genuinely radical left without a mobilized left wing labor movement. And for a variety of reasons, in my opinion, primarily due to the free land, the American labor movement was also always more conservative, small c, than, for example, European labor. European labor always had more radical groupings. There were radical groupings in U.S. labor, particularly in the late 19th and early 20th century, but I think by the time of its institutionalization in the 30s, 40s, and really into the 50s, it had been much less radical, and the leaders of labor essentially made a deal with the national security state that they weren't going to fundamentally challenge the Cold War and that they were going to be fundamentally anti-communist, which didn't necessarily have to be the case and not necessarily predicted if you're looking at 1880, that by, 80 years later, the American labor movement would be profoundly anti-communist and anti-radical. But that is what happened. Nixon is already the die was cast, in my opinion. And we could even go larger. I think the die was really cast in a macro historical sense in 1914, but that's a different question.
Well, how do you juxtapose your position with the rise of Black power, the rise of the radicals of the 60s and the civil rights movement? Would you argue that it actually was not a radical political constituency at all, but rather more liberal? Or would you also argue, as far as some have gone, that much of some of the Black power rhetoric was actually more conservative in terms of what it was actually administrative in terms of solution?
Well, I think when you're looking at the civil rights movement and the Black power movement, there are undoubtedly radical elements. But the problem is that it's trying to fit them into a left-right political binary that wasn't really used in the United States until the 1940s and doesn't really quite make sense, mapping onto American political ideologies, which until really World War II and really after World War II were not considered to be like on the same left-right spectrum as operated in Europe. So when you look at the Black power movement or you look at the civil rights movement, when you're trying to place it on a left-right spectrum, it never really quite fits. This is less true of Black Power, particularly in the 1960s when it's very self-consciously left-wing, because that had been the politics of the previous 20 years. But it certainly contained what I would consider to be socially conservative elements. It seemed to be patriarchal in some regards, but it also seemed to be genuinely revolutionary in other regards, and anti-capitalist and Marxist and pro-colonial and pro-decolonization. So it's my understanding is it's not my specialty, but my understanding is that it was an amalgamation of features that cannot so easily be placed into the left-right binary. I think the civil rights movement likewise had different moments, different people who are advocating particular things. I think Martin Luther King Jr. is a much more left-wing thinker than he has been amalgamated into the liberal imaginary, particularly, I mean, I think he was a left-wing thinker, frankly, from the beginning, but, you know, the Poor People's Campaign toward the end of his life, plans for the various Poor People's Marches, I think were quite radical, which probably didn't endear him to the official organs of state. So, no, of course, there's mass political movements. I mean, is it fair to call the civil rights movement a left-wing movement? Yes and no. We'd have to talk about what we meant by that, but it was certainly a mass-based political movement that shaped things. I would say that is absolutely correct. Also, one would notice that that's not really in the area of foreign policy or the macroeconomy. That was about domestic social legislation and obviously race, which is very important. But it's not the two arenas of social life that were explicitly cordoned off from the public, at least in my opinion, which were again foreign policy, macroeconomy.
So so let's focus on that particularly. For your purposes, the end of mass politics relatively importantly deals with two issues, particularly foreign policy.
Yes and no. So I think there's a very famous 2014 paper by Gillens and Page, I believe their names are, which just effectively shows that ordinary Americans' interests don't have an independent impact. I think that's the language that they use on policy, whereas business interests and, you know, capitalist interests do. So it's not just foreign policy and the macroeconomy, but I think that something like the civil rights movement would have been, you couldn't have that, or it wouldn't have been successful, at least even on that scale, to, for example, have the United States not be hegemon. I don't think that was ever going to be an option in the same way. I think for a variety of reasons over the 20th century, the liberal power elite, its ideology on race liberalized, became more progressive, or what we would call in today's language left, again, for a variety of reasons. And I don't think that power elite went left on the macroeconomy or went left on the foreign policy.
Well, here at This Is Revolution podcast, we postulate that the Cold War realpolitik had a lot more to do with that than people ascribe in terms of
Yeah, that's the Mary Dudziak argument. I mean, I think it's both. I think that within the mainline elite Protestantism, there's long abolitionist strands going back deep into the 19th century, not before. And so those became more powerful for a variety of reasons. I think the liberal Protestant mainline secularized, and that their sort of eschatology, which was previously millenarian and previously linked to, like, literally God after secularization, began to take different forms. And one of the things that was sort of a redemption narrative, redemption arc, was found in the civil rights movement. So I think Cold War geopolitics is one factor. I think secularization of the liberal Protestant elite is another factor. And I think the welcoming of previously populations not considered white, like Jews and Irish and Italians, into the liberal white power elite also shaped things. That there was recent examples of whitening, and people within those communities felt a kinship to the African-American community in the United States. So I think there's a lot going on there, but Cold War geopolitics is a factor.
Can you explain to the audience the very powerful term that you're using that comes from C. Wright Mill's book, The Power Elite? What is the power elite, and what are the institutions that make it architectural?
Sure. So there is, in the early 20th century, you ask a historian a question, they always say it's more complicated and it started earlier. So there were three theorists around the turn of the 20th century: Vilfredo Pareto, Gaetano Mosca, and Robert Michels. And they were theorists of the elites. Elite theorists. They developed something called the elite theory of democracy, or the elite theory of politics, and this notion of circulation of elites. And they had different exact opinions, but broadly speaking, that they were very influential in arguing that elites were really the most important members of modern society, that elites had the power, and that they were contraposed to this thing called the masses, which first began to be theorized in the late 19th and really in the early 20th century. And so this is later taken up by someone like C. Wright Mills, an American sociologist, actually very influenced by German sociology. It was really German sociologists, actually, like the guy I wrote my first book about, Hans Speyer, people like Emil Lederer, people like Siegfried Krakauer, who started theorizing in Germany this notion of the power elite and sort of trying to refigure Marxist theory, which is effectively between classes, in light of elite theories of democracy. And so these guys were exiled by the Nazis in the 1930s. C. Wright Mills is educated, I think, in the late 30s or 40s. I used to know this by heart, but I don't any longer. C. Wright Mills, if I remember correctly, was Hans Gerth, who was a German sociologist, actually translated Weber, like selections of Weber, came out in a book, I believe, called From Max Weber. And so Mills is very engaged with this German tradition of sociological thinking that focuses on the elite. And so he basically writes a book in the, I think it's 59, it's a 59 or 60 or 62, Power Elite is 56. Okay. So he writes a book in 1956 titled The Power Elite, which really doesn't applies these Weberian German insights into the 1950s Cold War United States. And he argues that power elites, military elites, political elites, economic elites are really the crucial, or at least are a very crucial part of the ruling of why society functions as it does.
I see. Exactly. And basically your argument is that they have been the crux of the policy progenitors in the United States for pretty much over a century. And they intentionally made that so by shifting away the ability of the demos, so the members of the Democratic members of society, from having an influence on politics, which is the
right. And this is sort of the ironic consequence of the New Deal, is that you can think about the institutions made in the late 1940s, the National Security Council, CIA, DOD, Council of Economic Advisors, you know, these alphabet soup agencies, which were really about, influenced by progressive era thinking about managing the world, like literally using experts and centralized institutions in the government to manage the world. So if the first New Deal was about the social democratic compromise in the domestic political economy, the second New Deal of the late 1940s was really about creating a institutional basis of global politics. And so I think what those institutions do, what they had as one of their I think intended consequences was that they helped make foreign policy into more of an elite sphere, a sphere where ordinary people wouldn't necessarily have as much influence. And there were a variety of reasons for this. I mean, in late World War II, early post-war period, there's a lot of social scientific studies that seem to demonstrate the ignorance of the masses, both of the masses in the United States, also the masses elsewhere. There's a bunch of labor agitation immediately after World War II, which really discomfited elites. Really, there's this fear of the rise of the masses. And then there's this emergence of the Cold War. So elites understand the US-Soviet struggle as an existential one. And so they are worried that ordinary people aren't necessarily want to commit themselves to fighting an existential, potentially decades-long war with the Soviet Union. So they had to wall off foreign policy. And then, of course, there's a renewed resurgence of anxiety about communism, the Red Scare, the Lavender Scare, what have you. And so this really closes off the social democratic, let's say, trend that was emergent in the United States throughout World War II, which is, of course, one of the greatest instances of central planning of all time.
Interesting. So how do we get from that point to the where we are today with after the post-civil rights era in terms of the rise of Nixonian, the kind of emerging of the getting off the gold standard and kind of the Dixon shock and all of that, moving into the neoliberal era? Does that further facilitate the push toward the end of mass politics in terms of its utility, or does it in any way give birth to a new types of floundering mass politics through things like the attempts to challenge of say South African apartheid in the 80s or other types of protests going into the say the first Gulf War or maybe the war on terror? How exactly does this end of mass politics manifests itself in the post-civil rights era?
It's a good question. So the most important thing is that the draft is ended, or I think more specifically, the draft is not renewed. So that effectively removes the bourgeoisie totally from fighting in their empire's wars. Vietnam, you know, obviously engendered a lot of campus unrest And so one of the compromises was that now that it was going to be an all-volunteer force, so people who didn't want to fight weren't going to have to fight in America's wars. So that's a huge thing. I think the end of Bretton Woods allows for the emergence of financialization, and financialization and the, you know, as the profit rate continues to fall from the 1970s onward, as deindustrialization happens and more of the economy progressively becomes basically just in a fake world of numbers and calculations, the technocratic skills, the math skills, quantitative skills required to operate in that world make it further difficult for ordinary people to basically exert claims and exert influence in the economic sphere. So the economy gets further pushed away from the ordinary person's influence, which is, of course, later manifested in the neoliberalism of Carter, Reagan, and beyond. So I think those two structural transformations really set the stage for what happens in the war on terror and beyond, which is that Americans are not really going to fight in those wars. These wars are for technological reasons, and the American obsession Sam Moyn has charted with making war more humane. Not only are not people not going to fight in these wars, but there's going to be robots who are fighting in these wars. And I think that basically, the major decisions were made earlier, but by the time of the war on terror, there was a whole system that was allowing these types of decisions to be made almost without any reference to public opinion. I mean, look at the Iraq War, those protests, look at basically any foreign policy thing that people protest. It doesn't really matter. Look at the response to the Great Recession, totally helped finance and Wall Street, didn't help ordinary Americans. We even though we vote, we don't live in any stretch of the imagination economic democracy. And so I think there are these serious drawbacks to the end of mass politics, even though we find ourselves here today.
Okay, well, now let's take this to today then. Now, in light of, you know, this is a very serious, it's a bit pessimistic and a bit gloom and doom, Danny. I'm sure you've been told that your position is...
I mean, I just think it's accurate.
Well, the thing is, though, one of the things in your piece you say is that you expect people to resign themselves to certain realities, and one of them is basically the fact that capitalism has won. And you know, it, you know, for many on the left to have to resign themselves to that is somewhat.
Well, you don't have to resign yourself. Just very quickly, sorry to interrupt. It's that a correct diagnosis is going to be the source of any actual change. So tricking yourselves isn't, I think, helpful in the medium terms. So I don't view it as necessarily pessimistic, but as trying to diagnose what's actually going on. Sorry.
Okay. Please. All right. That's fair. That's fair. I didn't mean to miscategorize what your position is on the subject matter. Since October 7th, we've had thousands, hundreds of protests all over the world in terms of what's going on in the Middle East after the perceived attacks of Hamas and the rise of an awareness of what's going on in Palestine that as I have not seen in my lifetime at all. I mean, I'm old enough to remember a position where a time where the power elite had a rock solid control of the consciousness of the Western world in terms of the utility of Zionism, in terms of the worldview in that era. It was unchallenged, it was unquestioned, and it was directly the case. If your theory of the end of mass politics is true, why does there seem to be such an effective peeling away of the veneer of legitimacy of Zionism in the consciousness of so many people in the United States and the body politic?
I don't think consciousness matters that much. To me, the reasons are effectively clear. It's that social media allows people to see what's happening on the ground. And that as we get further and further away from the Holocaust, people are less sympathetic to the Israeli project by dint of being further away from the Holocaust and not being connected to people who survived World War II and the genocide against the Jews. But I think it might be effective in raising consciousness. And I mean, frankly, I think that's generally true. I don't think it's a particularly salient issue for most Americans necessarily. It might be salient in the places that matter for the 2024 election for Joe Biden, particularly in the upper Midwest where there's a lot of Arab Americans. But I don't think it's really changed the United States' approach to Israel. And I don't think it's changed Israel's approach to Gaza.
Right. Well, that's the more logical response is that in the face of all of this protest and this awareness of what's going on campuses, the elite campuses of all the United States, what kind of effect has it actually had in terms of changing policy? So what exactly do you, are you saying that you don't think it will have any effect, or it's not possible to have any effect? What do you, what is your position on the capacity of these protests?
No, anything is possible. Anything is possible. I mean, I can't be for sure, but if I'm basing my analysis on what I consider to be how power functions in this country, as well as history, I don't think it's going to greatly affect either through the United States or through direct influence on Israel, what Israel, basically Israeli strategy vis-a-vis Gaza, vis-a-vis the West Bank. Maybe it will affect vis-a-vis the region, but that's because the U.S. doesn't want a war with Iran. That's not because of the protests. Yeah, I anything's possible. I just think it's unlikely.
Well, my question is this. If it's the case that these protests are having just a little effect, why is it that so much consternation is there about this role of social media in affecting this, the consciousness?
Because people are obsessed with the Ivy League, and people are obsessed with their children in particular. And I think the American Jewish establishment is losing the support of younger generations of American Jews. And I think that that's upsetting. I think there's a strong generational divide within the American Jewish community vis-a-vis Israel and the blank check the United States has given to Israel. So I think American obsession with elite colleges and internal Jewish debates about American Jews' relationship to Israel is responsible for a lot of the consternation that one sees in mainstream media sources. And also that it's a salient issue for Christian evangelicals as well. So people are interested in Israel for a variety of reasons. And it's a flashpoint on the left and has been since the 1970s in particular. So for all those reasons, I think it's engendered consternation.
Well, what's fascinating to me is that in terms of this endopolitics reality that you're talking about, in terms of its lack of functionality to use protests to come to reality, how do you explain phenomena like what's going on, what has happened recently in French West Africa, where the protests had led to so much destabilization that now France is in a position where it's literally trying to reorganize its relationship with these African nation states because they want the French boot off their neck. And it's causing a major kind of media concern in terms of the French Republic.
It's a great point, because I should clarify, I'm only referring to the United States. I would really need to look into much more what's happening in French West Africa to give a real answer on that. Even, I mean, I wouldn't even be comfortable saying it applies to the UK, even though my sense is that it does. And my sense is that it also applies to the core countries in the North Atlantic world, Germany, France, the UK, and the United States. But I'm really only speaking about the United States. So I take your point. This isn't necessarily a global theory of politics. I know Anton Yeager spends much more time thinking about Europe and writing about Europe than I have. So he's talked about that more, but I'm really speaking primarily to the United States.
Anton Yeager is the one who's come up with the concept of hyperpolitics. Are you familiar with his idea of hyperpolitics? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he has a book, Hyperpolitik, that I think is just been released auf Deutsch. So yeah, I'm familiar with it. I mean, to be honest, I'm not like mega familiar with it. I think it rhymes with what I say. I think Anton actually publishes one of his first pieces on hyperpolitik, I think like 2 days before I published my End of Mass Politics essay. So there's clearly something in the air that thinkers from that thinkers from a broadly similar ideological position are, I mean, to call myself a thinker, are arriving at similar conclusions and have similar concerns.
But what is fascinating to me also is that for someone of your age and your particular generation who comes out of the Bernie Sanders brigade, to say that the capacity of the demos to change things is limited is somewhat kind of shocking to me, because some would argue that this is the generation that had what put socialism on the map, had the most capacity to eventually change the political economy of the United States. Would you say that that was all kind of, you know, smoke in the air, or have you lost?
No, not at all. I mean, I think the president has unique powers in the United States, and that was essentially a Hail Mary pass. I mean, just demonstrated by the fact that how old Bernie was. He was literally from a different political generation almost totally. So that was an attempt to basically skip over the problems of mass organization, to skip over the problems of not having real left-wing labor unions, to skip over the problem of not having an institutionalized left in the United States was the Bernie Sanders presidential campaign. And I think if he won, he would have been able to do a lot, but he didn't win for a variety of reasons, and that basically Hail Mary pass missed.
So you're saying that you believe that his political rise was actually as a product of the lack of institutional left that was an attempt to make up the gap in some in a certain way?
I think his institutional rise was enabled by the obvious failure of a Democratic Party liberalism and neoliberalism broadly. I think that was a function of it. I think the promises made by liberalism after the end of the Cold War just didn't come through due to neoliberalism, due to the focus on deregulation, due to the basically classically liberal perspective of the American elite of both political parties. And absent those failures, particularly absent the fact that the middle class and upper middle class didn't effectively reproduce itself, Bernie was probably impossible. But because neoliberalism devours all that it encounters, it provided space for a national political candidate to win the support, particularly of educated millennials and others. I think he others as well. But when I think when you talk about like introduced socialism, you're really referring to elite media, which is populated by educated millennials, and there was obvious material reasons why they basically the failures of neoliberalism led them to support Bernie.
Interesting, interesting. Well,
I
let
mean, the
me.
only reason I take myself as a case in point, the only reason I knew what social democracy was is because I happened to study Germany in the 20s. And so I was like reading about social democracy in 2008, 2009, 2010. Like that was not a live political movement really until Bernie Sanders. So it was only going to be like strange people who otherwise encountered socialism were it not for Bernie.
So another question I want to ask you is that in your position in terms of the futility of mass politics in terms of its ability to bring forth change in terms of policy and those who create policy, my question has always been, I can understand you're saying that mass politics fails in terms of the left being able to influence things. Why does it seem that mass politics works for the right? When you see the mobilizations of Trumpism and their ability to get people on the ground to influence or maybe support their project and shape the direction that it's going, why is it that the ability of people who are within the Trumpist camp to influence their policyholders seems more effective than it does on the left if mass politics doesn't work? Is this something that's one-dimensional in terms of the political paradigm or tendency that it affects, or is it both sides of the actual pendulum?
I mean, my understanding is that it's not as effective on the right wing either. That studies demonstrate that ordinary people still don't have that much influence. That ordinary organized business interests are what have the influence, and that's a cross-party phenomenon. You know, think about large media companies. They donate enormous amounts to both political parties. I mean, if you're referring to January 6th, I could say that is an instance of mass politics. Of course, Trump didn't remain president. So in that instance, the state was still far more powerful than the organized mass. And if you're referring to something else, I'm not quite sure what you're necessarily referring to. I
I'm
mean, there's
talking
a
about,
popular.
for example, the movements to end CRT and all of these other educational movements that the move against DEI that are being roused in the
I
grassroots.
just view that as culture war bullshit, ultimately. Like that's the American culture war, which is going to be fought in elite media spaces. I don't think that's a particular example of mass politics. That's how I view it, at least. Like CRT, this is just like so the New York Times could write about nonsense and the Daily Wire could write back. These aren't particularly crucial issues, in my opinion. And you see it right now with the protests on campus, right? They don't seem to really care much about equity or inclusion when they're calling in the NYPD to clear out campuses. I think it was mostly bullshit corporate speak. Tyler Harper is, I think, correct about this. I don't know if you know him. If you should have him on. I think Tyler's a good dude. He's a professor. He's a comp lit guy at I think at Bates, and he studies the human instinction, but he's like become a little bit of a public figure more recently. And so he has a good point about, you know, you should have him on to talk about this. I agree with his point about corporate DEI, basically.
What's his position?
That university. Oh, he's been on. Okay, great. That universities are stuck between a rock and a hard place, and effectively because they market themselves as social justice people to incoming students. You know, Columbia, my alma mater, would always reference 1968, and my understanding is that they still do that now. But at the same time, they're militarily reliant on the donor class, which is more conservative in a variety of ways. So in the end, the donor class wins, and that all this, you know, radical stuff is window dressing to attract customers. But when the shit hits the fan, it's the capital that wins in the end.
Well, let me ask you a question. Understanding, and I don't want you to think that I'm hostile to your overall theory on the end of mass politics.
No, be hostile. I like hostility.
No, I actually think that your position has what's actually somewhat devastating to me is that there's truth to it. It makes a lot of sense, and it's quite logical in terms of its actual conclusions. But my position is that how can we change that reality? Because you're telling, you know, and the second thing is that what exactly is the solution to the ability of the power elite to concentrate so much role? And frankly, in the face of things like the rise of COVID, for example, that showed me that we have a power elite that is becoming more and more inept. Do you agree that the power elite is becoming more inept in their capacity to rule the affairs of governing society? Do you think that's actually true? Or have they been able to consolidate their power more effectively, and that there's a perception that they're actually losing their grasp? Because what I find is that the demos is rumbling with discontent about what's going on and how things are being ruled. And my question is, how does that translate into a real politics where we can get things to change in the society? Do you have a solution to that, or do you have any actually? Do you think that conclusion is incorrect?
Well, the solution is to subscribe to my podcast, American Prestige. That's step one. Other steps will be followed. What I think is that the power elite is not especially effective. I don't believe they're especially intelligent, cunning, or interesting, which is why it's always funny when I see sometimes leftists pretend that they're playing 25 dimension chess or 25th dimension chess, whatever it is, because I don't think that's true. But I think what might have happened was, as my boy Carl predicted, capitalism might now be so powerful and people might be so alienated from the functioning of the system that it essentially functions absent to human will, that the system itself is in some sense a living organism. The way that I put it before, people who have listened to me probably heard me say this, but it's like Skynet has become self-aware, that it doesn't matter what human beings want or what the human will is or what the will of the demos or what the will of the power elite is that capitalism is going to do what capitalism is going to do, which might be partially why someone like Elon Musk needs to buy Twitter or needs to go to outer space, because unlike someone like JP Morgan or John D. Rockefeller, he can't literally go into the economy and shape it. Capitalism might be too complex, it might be too institutionalized, and might be too global for it to be truly, for it to be easily subjected to the human will. Do I think it's possible? I hope it's possible. I mean, it would just be the classic things that people would normally do: analyze the system, identify what is actually going on, and try to find structural weak points wherever those are, and go after them. Maybe that's the long march through the institutions. I don't know. One would have to imagine that there is some way to tame it, but I think that the left is failing by using atavistic 20th century technologies and institutions like the mass protest to basically rage against a machine that is not listening.
Well, I want you to rephrase. That's a very loaded charge. The left is using atavistic tactics like mass protests to raise against the machine.
That's not listening.
Yeah. Do you actually believe that we have a left in the United States?
Not really, no. I mean, I think that probably there was no real chance once the working class of Europe fought each other in World War One. It's been an uphill struggle, to say the least, probably doomed. I think the state is just simply too complex. The economy is simply too complex it's not even like moving a cruise ship. It's like moving a planet. And I just have no real answer to how we would actually go about changing it. But it's certainly not using the tactics and strategies of an era that no longer exists. Of a Fordist era, you know, like protests are an industrial era strategy when people worked in factories and were able to do things like shut down an economy when the economy didn't exist on Amazon Web Services. It's not gonna affect things like it was able to back in the day. And people have an affective attachment to protests because there is no real left. So basically the left is just its memory. So they're emotionally attracted to what is literally just a tactic. And should be abandoned if it's not working. And I'd say it's pretty clear it's not working.
So I'm going to ask a question in terms of what is
happening. And again, in the U.S., I'm only talking about the U.S. right now.
So I'm going to ask a question in terms of what is habit politics. Can you give a succinct definition for our audience, if you don't mind?
I can't. I'm not familiar enough with what Anton says. Sorry. I could look it up. Anton, yeah, it's similar to what I'm saying. I'm looking it up, everyone. Maybe someone in the chat could tell me.
Netanyahu's position is that there's a period of time in which people become more interested in politics and political activity that is a hyper politics.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I think he's right. I mean, I think it was my friend Megan Day once said this to me, and I think it was right, is that like in the last decade or so, politics has become a way by which one self-brands in the neoliberal era. And that has happened in a moment when, as I think I've said, my position at least is that there's less and less ability to actually shape things. So it leads to this dialectical tension between hyper-politicization on one hand in terms of talking and thinking, and materially very little impact of that hyper-politics. So I think that's one of the reasons that people feel so disconnected and people feel so discombobulated in the modern era, is because of this tension, this dialectical tension. We haven't transcended it. Maybe the transcendence is impossible anymore. I don't know. But I think that's one of the reasons people feel strange today.
And that is very, I think, a very effective way in terms of notarizing what hyperpolitics is. So, Daniel, in the light of your position on the ineffective of mass politics, and your position that there is only a dubious left in the United States, what are the political centers that you think should be used to create a more effective strategy on how to address particularly what's going on in the Palestine-Israeli conflict right now?
It's very tough because, to be honest, I don't think there are any. I mean, that's like my brass tacks honest answer. I don't see a path to that policy change. The entire power elite supports it. The military supports it. It's not a vital American interest. So that makes it more likely for motivated groups and motivated client states to get to do what they want. I don't see a path to actually changing it.
Okay, there's another phenomenon I want to ask you your opinion on. I don't know if we've actually got your view on it. What are your thoughts on this development of this phenomenon I call multipolarity? What are your thoughts on it overall? I think we've talked about it before. Do you have any extensive opinions on it? I know that the Russian state is not your friend, but
I'm a friend of all, Pascal. Daniel Besnay is a friend of all. I think that a couple of things. I think the United States is still undoubtedly the hegemon. I think it is by far the most powerful nation on earth, both militarily and economically. However, at the same time, I do not believe that the United States' global hegemony is going to remain in the same form that it has remained since World War II. In particular, I don't think the United States is going to remain forever dominant in East Asia. My guess is that there's going to be some form of regional hegemonic transition over the next 40 to 50 years, which is probably natural given just China's sheer size and its sheer power. And even though that the United States will no longer be regionally hegemonic in East Asia, it will still be, I think, significantly more powerful than China into the foreseeable future, and it'll be hegemon, the hegemon.
Well, let me ask you a question as well in that regard. If we are at the end of mass politics and we are seeing the waning of the hegemony of the United States, does it not mean that that creates a potential fracture that will allow mass politics to perhaps cause the state to react to the demos in a way in which could create policy that is more in line with the demands of the people out of fear of losing its possible hold on the overall condition of the globe?
I'm not necessarily sure that I would see the connection between relative decline of U.S. hegemony, because the U.S. will still be incredibly powerful, and they'll still be, I mean, I do think Americans get less and less from the empire, but there's still pride and desire to be the leading nation in the world. There's American exceptionalism is still quite powerful. So I don't think, at least in the foreseeable future, that the hegemony is going to decline to the point where it will engender a social crisis at home. Again, partially because the empire, unlike, let's say, the British Empire, you don't need thousands upon thousands upon thousands, tens of thousands of people to actually police it, to actually run it. This is a very elite-directed affair. And as technology becomes more and more dystopian, you'll be able to do, which is already being done, surveil and threaten from Colorado, as opposed to, you know, going out to Waziristan, as the case may be.
So if that has been the case, then why does the state spend so much money on surveillance technique? If they're so in control, it shocks me why they spend so many resources to, you know, basically neutralize dissent in this country in terms of.
Yeah, so I think this is a fundamental misinterpretation of the left. That's what bureaucracies do. They expand over time and spend an enormous amount of money on things that may or may not be actually useful. It's not like the state is a brain that is rationally deciding to spend money. I think this is just kind of iron law of bureaucracy stuff. And the DOD, for example, is a 70-year-old bureaucracy. The accrual of institutional pathways over that time, particularly given the fact that the American state, I would say, is a strange mixture of both state and parastatal institutions, makes it, you know, could a lot of this, I think, is just wasteful spending, like on the F-35 or on surveillance technologies that like don't actually do that much, or that, you know, the DOD spends enormous amount of money on contracting these companies to surveil Americans and pumping money through the system. I don't think there's necessarily a rationality there that indicates that these are necessarily so effective or important. For example, I don't think ad tech is that effective, but it's what the entire internet runs on. And this also has to do with the falling rate of profit and the fact that financialization allows money to be sort of artificially made in space, not based on any real investment in anything. So that where the financialization point comes back into the story.
I wish we had a much more optimistic way of prescribing a challenge to these phenomenon. Do you see, how do you see these three things affecting the presidential election?
It's tough to know. I don't know. I mean, I think Trump could win. I think Biden could win. I don't know necessarily how these much larger process. It's like a climactic metaphor, and the election's like a storm. So it'll affect it in some way, but it's difficult to make a causal claim between what happens. But I think Trump has a real chance of winning.
Do you think that Biden loses Michigan because of what's going on in Palestine?
Tough to know. It's tough. I don't know. I think that's very hard to predict. You know, to what degree is the uncommitted vote going to matter, going to translate to the actual vote in November? What things are going to happen between now and then that could shape the election? I think it's very difficult to know, actually.
So I heard you were on Bill Maher. Is that true? Was that true that you were on the Bill Maher
show? Not only was I on Bill Maher, Pascal, tomorrow I'll be on Fresh Air by NPR.
Are you serious?
Yeah, I'm serious.
You're doing all the lip shows, man. We're going to have to pull your radical card, dude.
I'm enlightening the public. I'm public education. But so you get the Bessner exclusive beforehand, though.
You're going to be on Fresh Air. Do you have a new book out? Do you have a new book out?
Right? No, it's just my Harper's article that I'm actually coming on This Is Revolution to talk about with Jason, I think, next week.
About Hollywood next week in May 7th.
Hollywood. Yep.
What was your experience like being on Bill Maher?
I was on with Glenn Lowry.
Glenn
and I are buds. Glenn, interestingly enough, so the people that I studied for my book, Glenn was trained by them. And I find Glenn to be a very fascinating figure because I think it was very influential. His generation of sort of second and third generation Jewish immigrants, social scientists who also assimilated into American society vis-a-vis PhDs and vis-a-vis social science, I think were very influential on Glenn. And so I think there's a very fascinating story to tell there about conservative Black intellectuals. Glenn isn't even, I wouldn't even define him necessarily as a conservative. He's much more of an American figure who, he's not easily placed on the left-right spectrum, but he's to me a very interesting figure who is kind of the, emerges from the world that I studied in my book. But yeah, so I was on with Glenn. I mean, as you can imagine, it's surreal, as everyone says when they go on TV. The studio is smaller than you think. And didn't have much interaction with Bill. You know, you kind of go in, you go into the dressing room, they kind of call you, you have a conversation. I got a couple of applause lines. That's what they tell you. You got a few applause lines. And yeah, that was that. That was about a year ago.
Yeah, his politics are pretty atrocious.
Yeah, well, it was interesting because like we spent a lot of time talking about the university, right? And he was, as far as I can tell, he was into the my criticism of administration, you know, and the lack of faculty governance. I'm trying to remember what else we talked about. I talked about how teachers needed to make more. I remember that got applause. Honestly, it's difficult. Oh, yes. we were talking about Black crime. I was asked about Black crime because Glenn obviously writes a lot about that. And I just basically disagreed with they tried to make it a cultural issue. I'm like, it's the economy, if anything. And, you know, how could you ignore
it? That's the main reason why I'm not a fan of Glenn Lowry, because he tries to make it seem that Black people are pathological.
Well, it's very much a 70s era response. I mean, like when you situate it historically, it's very much a part of this, you know, this response to the urban crisis in the late 1960s and this memory he has of growing up on the south side of Chicago and like what he imagines as to be more coherent communities. But I think he totally misses the economic basis of it. So it's I've fought with him about this before. It's a totally superstructural analysis, which is pathological in a sense, but I don't think it's interesting. He doesn't psychologize it, right? It's about like cultural reproduction, you know. It's pathological in a sense, but then like he broke with Charles Murray, you know, big time. He broke with these other two sociologists who wrote what he basically described in the New Republic in like an 8,000 word essay in the 1990s as a racist book that tried to argue that African Americans were inherently less intelligent. So he's gone against those things. So it's not about like psychology, it's about like culture. So, to me, he's an interesting figure which embodies sort of the possibilities and tensions of African American intellectual life in the second half of the 20th century and into the 21st.
You're way more generous than I am.
as you should. You should have Glenn on. He'd probably come on.
I would. I that would be an interesting conversation in and of itself on a variety of issues. Well, listen, we're coming up on the hour, Daniel. I appreciate you coming on and tackling, going through these difficult theories with us. Would you be willing to come on with me again for another mile and discuss any other of your work?
Always. I think I tweeted, you're one of my favorite podcasters, even though I didn't recognize Tyler was on. I think I actually did know that. I think you're one of the greats today. You remind me a lot of Matt Chrisman, that sort of scope.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so Matt's one of the best podcasters, and I think you're one of the best podcasters. So happy to come on whenever you'll have me.
I appreciate that, brother. Thank you very much. Well, thank you for coming on and being a guest on this Revolution Podcast. For those who are new to the show, like and subscribe, hit the bell, share with your friends. This is the Mile Mile Hour, the last Wednesday of the month, and we'll be coming back and having these more regularly. I'm Toussaint. You would like to come in and join us? Do you have anything you'd like to say? Is Toussaint there?
Yeah, I'm here. Please like and subscribe. Subscriptions are super important, guys. It means a lot for us to see the numbers and to know that you support us.
Yeah, like and subscribe. Like and give subscribe. That money. This is labor. Compensate labor.
There you go. All right. And Toussaint, we are
out.
If I tell any secrets of the Mau Mau, this oath will kill me. If I am called in the night and refuse to come, this oath will kill me. If I see anyone steal white man's property, I must help him. I must hide what he gives me and say nothing, or this oath will kill me.
The whole system in this country, the economic system, is such that jobs are scarce. Automation is limiting jobs. It's decreasing jobs. And as automation eliminates the job opportunities, legislation will not create job opportunities. All it will do is bring about friction and hostility between the two races.
You see, there will be no progressive revival if Black folks are not deeply involved in it.
I will obey all orders of the Mau Mau, or this oath will kill me.